Chief Justice Annette King Lindsay, you are presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Calling the third case of the day, 20AP-225, Louis Bogotis versus Marcus Zitkeitel. Okay. All right, your appearances, please.
Laura O'Gorman of the Schlemer Law Firm for the defendant respondent.
Attorney Sean Govern of the DeWitt Law Firm, appearing for Tom Friend as co-counsel, and I appear on behalf of the plaintiffs, Louis Pagodas, Hannah Pagodas, and two LLCs, Seed Properties LLC and Kearns Management LLC.
All right, thank you. Go ahead and have a seat. Attorney O'Gorman, if you could start, please. 25 minutes followed by 30, rebuttal for 5.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a case about legal malpractice between the plaintiffs and their attorney, or at least should be. My client, her ex-husband, and their home inspector were sued by a series of individuals and entities on a number of claims to the sale of her $610,000 home in 2017. The Court of Appeals generously referred to the pleadings as inartful, although I might use other less forgiving terms. The plaintiffs to this case included the signatory to the offer to purchase, Elias Pagodas, Seed Properties LLC, which was assigned the property as evidenced by a warranty deed, Kearns Management, which obtained the property from Seed through yet another warranty deed, and Hannah Pagodas, who is the wife of Elias Lewis.
Ms. O'Gorman, I hate to interrupt you. Can you just maybe put your mic down just a little bit? I'm missing some of your words. Thank you.
Thank you. Without specifically identifying which plaintiffs were bringing which claims or against which defendants, the plaintiffs, as a group, sued the defendants, as a group, for breach of contract, even though Amy had no contract with Hannah Pagodas or Kearns Management, and even though all of Elias Pagodas' interest was transferred to Seed by assignment. The plaintiffs also all brought claims for various types of misrepresentation, even though Amy had not made any representations to anyone other than the buyer, Seed, through the real estate condition report. When the Circuit Court dismissed all of the claims in the original and amended complaints, finding that the representations in a real estate condition report do not follow the property in perpetuity, that Kearns would be entitled to rely on representations made by Seed, but not by the previous owner, and that Seed had suffered no injury, the Pagodas plaintiffs amended the complaint for a second time, their third attempt, asserting the same claims, all while appealing the order underlying this action. A second motion to dismiss was brought by Amy and by all of the other defendants regarding the second amended complaint, which was again granted. That decision was appealed in Court of Appeals case number 2020-AP-1198, but was dismissed in April of 2021 for lack of jurisdiction based on the Pagodas plaintiff's attorney's failure to file that appeal properly. As such, there is a standing order for dismissal with prejudice of the claims in the second amended complaint, which was the operative complaint at the trial court level and asserted the same contractual and misrepresentation claims against Amy after the first order for dismissal was entered. In the Pagodas plaintiff's appeal to the Court of Appeals in this case, they asserted that Amy's inclusion of two warranty deeds with her dismissal filings meant that the court was required to follow summary judgment procedure and had somehow erred. On appeal, Amy asserted that the court was free to take judicial notice of the warranty deeds, and the Court of Appeals viewed that point as conceded, addressing the entirety of the procedural arguments in one large footnote. From there, the Court of Appeals, seemingly compelled to rectify plaintiff's counsel's blunders, overcompensated by adopting new law and setting dangerous precedents for sales of all kinds in this state. Real estate transactions, used car sales, even business transactions.
Counsel, do you agree that, I want to focus on Seed for just a minute. According to the complaint, the one that we care about, I guess, I do have some questions about, the representations in the complaint versus the briefing, but that's more for your opposing counsel. But the complaint says Seed purchased the property, right? So I'm sort of operating under that because we're in motion to dismiss world. Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that Seed doesn't lose the ability to challenge any misrepresentations merely because they transferred the property?
Yes, I do agree with that statement.
So is your argument with Seed entirely premised on the failure to show damages? Is that where you're resting your argument there? Or if you could just address Seed in particular, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yes, Your Honor. So we are not taking the position that there is no recovery against Amy solely because there was an assignment and then a transfer. That is not the case. We are saying that based on these facts, the way it was pled, the way it was briefed in addition to that, I suppose, there was no allegation of a specific injury to Seed. Instead, the allegation was that, repeatedly, Louis Bagudis had purchased the property. He had put in the money for the property. He was essentially the one damaged, and also that there remained issues on the property that still needed to be repaired, although the property is in the name of Kern.
So, I mean, the complaint says plaintiff suffered pecuniary damages. We just care about the complaint. I mean, they don't need to say much more in order to allege damages, obviously, because we're just dealing with a motion to dismiss, right? So they have to put to the proof down below. Why wouldn't that be enough? Again, and I'm just focused on Seed for just a minute. Why wouldn't that be enough to get you past the motion to dismiss stage on the damages point? If you agree that Seed purchased the property, and you agree that Seed could bring a claim based upon misrepresentations if Seed suffered damages, and Seed in their complaint says, well, the complaint says Seed, interpreting it, you know, as generously as we interpret complaints, which is pretty generously, suffered pecuniary damages. Why isn't that enough?
So in this case, I think the drafting of the pleadings did not help. But when the trial court looked at what had been filed, it found that Seed had suffered no injury, regardless of that vague reference to someone being damaged. When Amy alleged that there had been no damage to Seed, that it had essentially owned the property for a short period and then transferred it out, there was no response by the plaintiff's attorney to insist that Seed had any damage. There was no damage alleged from that point forward.
But again, it's a motion to dismiss. I mean, it's a motion to dismiss. We take the pleadings as true. We're not asking for proof. We're not looking for evidence. We're not looking for anything to back it up at this stage. We're just looking at what the complaint says. The complaint says suffered damages, suffered pecuniary damages, suffered money damages. I don't know what those are, and I understand the argument why that may be very difficult to prove, but the complaint says it.
And I think the Court of Appeals misunderstood what happened. I think the Court of Appeals tried to search for a remedy because they took the trial court's decision as saying, too bad, you know, nobody is allowed to sue for this even though there's this alleged misrepresentation. And I don't think that's what happened. I think the circuit court said, I don't see how you possibly have any injury. That's an error. But I don't see how you have any injury, so therefore, right. That's why you can't proceed.
So, this is really a question of law for us. We've all got the complaint in front of us. Why isn't it enough? Suffered pecuniary damages. That's just what it says. Why isn't that enough? If your only argument on Seed is the damages point, the complaint says suffered pecuniary damages. Why isn't that enough?
I think the court looked beyond the specific complaint or said, hey, I don't really care about the lower courts.
I mean, we're reviewing this on our own de novo. We're not giving deference. There's no factual findings here. So my question to you is, why isn't that enough?
All right. And I guess what I'm saying is I don't know that it isn't enough. I think that saying they allege damages, from that point, we then said, what are they? And they had no answer. So if it, I guess my bigger concern is that if we say, okay, we've got to go back and figure out what Seed's damages are, if that's what we're doing. The Court of Appeals went off on a tangent about Seed recovering for Kearns' damages, which was kind of an offshoot of what should have happened. So I don't disagree necessarily that saying there are damages isn't enough. I think that we have those couple of issues of what damages is Seed entitled to recover, and then beyond that, we have the issue of the claims, the same claims, being dismissed with prejudice in the same action on a different order. So I think that sort of poses a problem, too, even if we say, all right, let's go back and figure out what they are. We don't think there are any. We'll do a motion for summary judgment. Fine. But if we're going to do that, there's this issue of those same claims already being dismissed in the same case, which I think poses an issue.
Even if damages were sufficiently pled by Seed, wouldn't the economic loss doctrine prohibit recovery under a theory of common law misrepresentation?
It would. And for the strict responsibility misrepresentation, that is another avenue that we could pursue to eliminate the claims. And I think one of our co-defendants did bring that as sort of a secondary portion to one of their motions to dismiss, which was granted on that second set of complaints, really the third, but second amended set of complaints. So, yes, I think there are problems, but I think the Court of Appeals overreacted to the problem because Wisconsin law does allow third parties to sue, but not necessarily in the way that the Court of Appeals fashioned with the restatement of torts. In this case, what should have happened is there should have been an assignment. A sign from Kearns to Seed, Seed to Kearns, I mean, there are a number of ways you could do it. But any decent plaintiff's attorney, when they have a client walk in the door, they sit down and they say, okay, what are the facts of this case? And then they think about it. And they say, who can recover and what can they recover for? And in this case, the plaintiff's attorney should have recognized, I can't sue everybody for breach of contract. They're not all in contract with each other. I can't sue everybody for misrepresentation. Someone has to have made a representation to me. So I think there are two options that come to mind. One would be the assignment, where you transfer the claims or the damages to a person who can then bring that claim and have damages. Or alternatively, although more onerous, you could sue backwards. You could say, all right, Kearns has damage. Kearns is upset about that. They're going to sue Seed. Seed can then turn around and pursue Amy. That makes sense. We can already do that. We don't need to adopt the Section 533 of the Second Restatement of Torts to get that job done. I think the avenue exists already for people who need it in this state. And what we're doing is, I guess it's not worth it in terms of what will happen or what I anticipate will happen if we say, okay, now you can skip the line. Instead of going back to the person who you know, the person who you dealt with, you can now jump. You know, instead of suing one back, you can go three back or five back.
So what are you asking from us? I hear you asking for us not to adopt the restatement. But in terms of the what we have, and you've outlined different ways they could do this. They didn't. So we have the case we have.
Right.
And you just admitted, I think, to Justice Hagedorn's questions that it's possible that Seed could have a claim or claims. But that obviously that stuff would have to be worked out by the court and go back down to do that, which is what was being remanded back to the court. So what would you like us to decide? If we were, you know, if you were us and you're writing this, what would you want it to say?
Certainly. So The Court of Appeals did remand the case, but they remanded everybody. They just said, this is a mess. You guys go deal with it. I don't know. Somebody probably has a claim, and one of you figure it out. And what I would like, in a perfect world, would be a map, a guidebook, something to say, okay, well, we know this person can't recover for this. We know this person can't recover for this. And I think it mandates dismissal on a lot of the claims.
Which ones? Are you going to
sure.
argue that?
Yes, I will.
Or, okay.
Yes, I will. So I think everything other than seed, is gone. And then, like I said, I have some concerns about how that proceeds at the lower court level when there's another competing order that dismisses the claims with prejudice. But seed and its damages, that's it. And it's our position that without an assignment, the claims of a party who wasn't assigned anything have to be dismissed. That was another issue with the Court of Appeals, is that they said that, well, everybody just go back and fix it. And I don't think that's possible. I don't think I can start up a lawsuit and say, I'm going to get an assignment, so I'll go ahead and I'll start it today, and then, you know, next week or whenever I'll get it. I don't think that makes any sense. There's persuasive authority on that. On the insurance case that the Court of Appeals cited, Edgewood Manor, that basically Edgewood didn't have the assignment at the time it brought the case, and so there you go, they're dismissed out. So
just to drill down on, just to follow up on what Justice Dallet just asked you in your answer, I think what she asked you was, looking at all the parties and looking at all five claims, what is it that you are asking us to do? And in response to this, you said everything other than seed is gone.
Right.
Okay. Are you saying that we could send it back to the trial court on all five causes of action?
Against seed, I don't think that we have had that argument yet. I think there would be other motions about the economic loss doctrine and whatnot, but I don't think that's really for discussion, or I don't think that's something that could happen between here and the trial court. I think that's something that would happen at the trial court level. We were just alleging that there was no standing.
Okay, so you're not asking us to go claim by claim and figure out claim one, does seed have a cause of action for claim one, claim two?
Correct.
You're not asking us to do that, correct?
Correct, okay. Because seed is the buyer. Amy's the seller, seed's the buyer. We all know how that goes. Those claims that exist, the 100.18 breach of contract, those claims are all fine if there are damages, which, again, we assert there are none. But even if we have to have that fight, that's the only fight we should be having. I don't believe that we should be remanding it back and saying, let's all go to the circus and see what's going to happen. I don't think that's necessary. I think that the claims can be dismissed on basically everything else. For Elias Bagudis, I don't think he has any claims. His wife...
Just stop a minute.
Okay.
Why don't you think he has any claim, either for misrepresentation or breach of warranty?
Certainly. So he doesn't purchase the property. So he basically, his signature on the offer to purchase is Elias Bagudis and Nora signs. He never buys anything, so I don't think that he can, under like the 100...
Well, he doesn't take legal title to anything. I'm not sure he never buys anything is accurate. But.
Okay. Well, he doesn't take legal title to it, and when he does that, the claims that are based on, you know, misrepresentation that require someone to purchase something or to act.
Well, you know, there's another way of looking at the misrepresentation, which is based on the condition of the property as compared with the report that was given on the condition of the property, right?
Sure.
Okay. And he could have taken title to the property, but perhaps after he looked at the condition of the property on the report, thought it was in good condition, that's why he assigned it over to an LLC to do the purchase, okay? And the LLC did the purchase. So I'm not so sure it's quite so clear that he has no damages just because he didn't take title.
Well, I think that the representations in the real estate condition report are made to the buyer. And so
that's correct.
So the buyer is Seed.
But that you're talking about what actually happened. At the time the condition report was given, it was Lewis or his assigns.
That's correct.
Okay, so he was a buyer for a short period of time and decided not to maintain that hat on his head, but to deal with the property in another way. So at least for me, I don't see it quite so clear cut. For Lewis, I do see what you're saying about Seed and what might be there. How about breach of contract? There was a good argument, I think, made in your brief that there was no breach of contract claim for anybody.
Sure. And I think that the contract, again, is between the buyer and the seller. But then we get into these other parties that are all suing for breach of contract, even though they're not in privity. So I think that's...
And they're not, you're assuming they're also not third-party beneficiaries, because they could be third-party beneficiaries, right?
I disagree with that, okay. Only because for someone to be a third-party beneficiary of a contract, it would have to be specified somehow. Somebody would have to know about it. I don't think that this is good enough to where Amy should have known that they were purchasing the property for someone else. And that is, we did bring that up in briefing because the Court of Appeals kind of went on a tangent about that, that in relation to Seed being able to recover for the damages of Kearns, that, oh, it's like a parent, and if a parent gifts a property to their child, you know, the parent should be able to recover. But I don't think that's right either. I think that, again, if it's a parent and a child, the child can assign to the parent. Worst case scenario, the child sues the parent for something. But realistically, if it really was a parent buying a property for a child, they would be a third-party beneficiary because the person would know, hey, this mom and dad are paying for it, but this property is going to belong to the kid. Presumably the kid's going to be involved. It might even say so in the offer to purchase. So I think there would be more there in the case of a third-party beneficiary than there is here. I don't think there's enough here to say that everybody knew or could even reasonably expect that the property was going to be purchased either for Seed or for Kearns.
Well, I don't think that that's true, given that the offer to purchase is for Lewis or assigns. So it was never a secret from the beginning that this whole deal could be assigned to somebody else. Now, obviously, the offer to purchase doesn't say who might front the money for it, and there are lots of things in the record about where the money came from, but I don't think it was a secret that this wasn't necessarily Lewis who was doing the whole deal here.
Certainly. Thank you, Justice. And I do think that is accurate, but then we're saying that the Aura Signs part is the third-party beneficiary, which is Seed, which we already say is the buyer. So that doesn't change anything in terms of our analysis.
So you agree that Seed can have a claim for breach of contract? I just heard you kind of say they didn't, and I just want to clarify that.
I think they do.
Okay.
I think they do. I think the issue is that they don't have any damages.
Based on what? The real estate condition report or something else?
The offer to purchase. That the offer to purchase is made to Elias Pagoudis or Assigns, and at this stage, all we have is and or Assigns, and we have a property that doesn't show up in Elias's name. It shows up in the name of Seed Properties. So, essentially, we can infer from those actions that Seed is the assign that was mentioned in the offer to purchase.
And we don't have the offer to purchase as part of our record. So we have no idea if there's an express warranty in there, right? I mean, that's not, we're just dealing with a failure to state a claim.
That's correct.
Okay.
So basically what I hear you saying is if we send this case back to the circuit court, we should send it back only in regard to Lewis and Seed. And with Lewis and Seed, there could be misrepresentation if they can show damages. And with Seed, there could also be a breach of contract. So that's your position.
Almost. So yes, yes to, yes to Seed, not to Lewis. I don't believe Lewis, I think he assigned all of his interest in the contract to Seed.
No, but I was saying he has a claim for misrepresentation.
And I
don't think so.
I don't think so.
You don't think he has any damages from it?
I think that the misrepresentation is the real estate condition report that flows through the offer to purchase, and that only happens for people who are part of that contract. And I'm saying that the people who were part of that contract were the defendant, Amy Keitel, and Seed Properties.
Okay. So I think Lewis was obviously, he signed it, so he was, I think, a party to the offer.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I think that there was also the argument, I believe by the Court of Appeals, that Lewis signed it as an agent of his LLC, that that's also a possibility.
Okay. All right. Yep. All right.
Statutorily, a real estate condition report is not a warranty. So I just heard you say that the breach of contract claim is through the offer to purchase, but the hook is the real estate condition report, but it's not a warranty. It's expressly not a warranty. So where is the breach of what then?
Well, I think the offer to purchase says that, I apologize, you guys don't have it.
Well, but it's outside the record. What does it usually say?
Yes, right. The standard form language basically says that you are selling. Oh, I apologize. My light's on. If I can just
finish your sentence.
Finish. Okay. If the
I don't want to withdraw the question. I'm just trying to understand: is the real estate condition report the part of the offer to purchase that you think would give rise to a breach of contract claim?
Sure. So in the standard offer to purchase, it says basically I'm representing that there are no other issues other than what's disclosed in the real estate condition report. So I think they're linked in together through the offer to purchase.
Right.
Thank you.
All right.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, my name is Sean Govern from the DeWitt Firm. I'm appearing as co-counsel on behalf of Tom Friend, who is chief counsel in this case and is dealing with some medical issues. I represent the plaintiffs, Elias, also known as Louis or Louis Pagotis, his wife Hannah, and the two LLCs, Seed, and I'll call it Seed and Kearns for abbreviation. I think that the briefs and the discussion and oral arguments so far today identify what I think are seven issues. And those seven issues first start generally with whether or not the plaintiffs, generally, in this lawsuit have standing to pursue the claims asserted. More specifically, secondly, whether Louis Pagotis has standing as the recipient of the misrepresentations from Amy Keitel, which are accepted as true because this is a motion to dismiss. So those misrepresentations, the fact that there are misrepresentations is taken as true. Even though he does not own the property and did not take title to the property. Third, whether Seed Properties, who did take title to the property, has standing, even though they do not currently own the property. And whether Kearns Management, which does currently own the property but was not party to the contract, whether they have standing. Then I think we get into some of the other issues which have been bantied about in the briefs, whether the affirming of the Court of Appeals decision somehow creates liability in perpetuity, an infinite line amongst sellers and buyers way down the title chain. Sixth, whether the affirming of the Court of Appeals decision somehow sets back Wisconsin limited liability law in that it eliminates somehow the established principle that LLCs are separate from their entities, their entities are separate from their members, Seventh, whether the restatement second of torts, section 533, whether it's been adopted or should be adopted, regardless whether that's an appropriate application in the Court of Appeals decision. All of these...
Counsel, I'd like to... I want to make sense of just some of the stuff in the briefing. The complaint throws me off. I'm going to... So the complaint that we're supposed to be operating under says Seed purchased the property, and that Kearns was assigned the property, and that that Lewis and Hannah are the only members of Kearns and Seed, and through those entities have a direct financial interest in the property. Your brief says that Lewis purchased the property. In fact, the affidavit says that Lewis purchased the property, but the complaint says that Seed purchased the property. And then there's some argument in the briefing that no assignment ever took place from Lewis to Seed. But I don't know how to make sense of that since the complaint says something entirely different. It's confusing because obviously in a motion to dismiss, I care what the complaint says, but you're making arguments in defense of your motion to dismiss based upon your complaint that are different than your allegations in your complaint. What would you like us to do with that?
I would like to say that that is somewhat irrelevant, the confusion in the wording there. The fact of the matter is Lewis Pagotas was on the contract. Lewis Pagotas is the managing sole member of both of the LLCs. He's an agent by definition under 183 because the LLC acts through its members and its managing members are authorized. And so at the end of the day, I believe these LLCs are the recipients of the misrepresentation.
Let me be a little more precise then, just so I can make sure I narrow it down. Can we take, for purposes of our deciding this case, from your complaint that Seed purchased the property?
Yes.
Okay. So we can accept that. All right. If Lewis's sole Lewis and Hannah. The complaint says that their interests, their financial interests, are through their status as the members of these two other organizations.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand how they personally could suffer damages simply because they're members of an organization that purchased a property. Could you explain that? I understand that Lewis was on the original offer to purchase but never purchased it. So you have a... You know, an individual who never purchased a property, and then according to the complaint, their interest, their financial interest, is solely through these two other organizations, these two other LLCs. So how could Lewis personally have been damaged?
Assuming that the LLC is the title holder of the property, which it is, either one of them at one point had title, there are losses that are related to diminution of value, loss of bargain. The sole members, their value in the LLC is tied to the profits, the losses, and the values of the assets.
But LLCs are separate entities.
Correct.
They are not the individual.
Correct.
They are not sole proprietorships.
Correct.
They are not the individual Lewis or Hannah. They are the LLC.
Correct.
And you sign on behalf of an LLC as what?
Correct.
The member, right?
That's correct.
So everything here looks like they were acting as a member of the LLC, right?
Well, not at the outset. Louis Pagotas signed that contract, and it says in the contract, contemplated Louis Pagotas or his assigns. So everybody was on notice that Louis could take title or Louis could take title through an LLC.
Right, and he took title through an LLC.
Correct.
So, I mean, just put this backwards. What if the deal didn't go through the way it did and someone wanted to sue Louis individually and it was the LLC who was supposed to be buying it? Would Louis take the position that he's individually liable?
He would not because of the LLC separateness. But let me present this to the court. As a sole member and as an agent of the LLC, if Louis Pagotas had made a misrepresentation to Amy Keitel as part of the transaction and acting as an agent, Amy Keitel could sue the LLC. Could sue the LLC. My problem with this case is why not the converse?
Could she sue him? Could she sue him individually?
She could not sue him individually.
So why should he have rights that wouldn't otherwise exist under our law in Wisconsin?
Well, because he was the party that received the misrepresentation. We do have two statutory claims that do not require privity.
What if a real estate agent received it? Does the real estate agent all of a sudden have a claim?
No, because they're not a party, and they don't take possession, and they don't have damages that flow from the misrepresentation they received. Now, if they get sued because they transfer that information on, then they would have standing and they would have damages. We don't know, but the record is unclear, but somebody's paying a mortgage and not getting use of it.
Okay.
The record is clear that Louis Pagotas and his family was going to live there, and they're not living there. They're not getting use.
All right, so there's two separate issues with respect to Louis Pagotas. There's the contract, and there's the statutory misrepresentation claims, and the idea that you want us to also adopt the restatement for other types of misrepresentation. With respect to the contract, I hear you concede a few times that Seed purchased the property. So don't you agree that Louis does not have a contract claim?
I do not. I do not concede
that.
Why
is that?
Well, he was the party at the contract at the time. He received the fraudulent or the inaccurate information, and he acted upon it. The elements for the breach of contract warranty is affirmative material fact was delivered. It induced him to do something, whether in his individual capacity or as the agent sole member.
Now you're mixing the LLC up again, so I see where the confusion is. All right, let's pivot. I don't know that I'm going to get the answer that I'm looking for there, but with respect to the misrepresentation claim, I originally thought he might have that, but now I look at your complaint and I see that the only damages that are alleged with respect to Louis are damages related to the property, the purchase of the property. I don't see any other allegation here other than it's placing the property in the condition it was represented to be in, the cost of all repairs, attorney's fees, cost of this action. I don't see, I guess in theory maybe he could have some misrepresentation claim, but what's the injury that you've alleged on his behalf with respect to that that's other than the property loss?
The wherefore clause of the amended complaint lists loss of value, also cost of repair. If you go directly to paragraph 8, sub 0 of the amended complaint, it expressly states, and this has been incorrectly cited by the petitioner today and in the briefs, paragraph 8, sub O, expressly identifies that plaintiff, now it doesn't say which plaintiff, that's why we need to have this remanded, has incurred over $7,000 to remedy the landscaping problems to preserve the foundation.
Okay, so do you agree that the only damages that Louis is alleging under any claim, whether it be false representation or contract, is related to the property and repairing the property? Is that what you're... That's what O says, too. So I just want to make sure that's what you're saying.
Well, the problem with O is it says plaintiff.
Well, we're trying to sort out these claims, and I'm trying to understand what you're alleging is the injury to Louis Pagotas as a result of a false misrepresentation. And what I hear you saying, what I read in the complaint, is it's all related to repairing the property or purchase of the property that he does that is not his because it was assigned.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think it's important to point out that there are damages specifically alleged. The argument that they had made was, while transfer alone may not automatically eliminate standing, in other contexts, where the transferor has incurred damages for diminished property value or cost of repairs. That's the petitioner's concession. No such allegations were made in the Pagoda's plaintiff, by the Pagoda's plaintiffs, but they were. The wherefore clause clearly states that. Paragraph 8O states that. And all the other alleged misrepresentations and the remedies necessary to do that state a cause of action of specific allegations.
Did I hear you say Pagoda's is the only managing member of the LLC?
Correct.
Who else, if Seed as an LLC is buying it, who else should they have handed the condition report to?
Lewis is the only person they could have handed it.
Well, you're talking about the damages in the wherefore clause, and there they do ask for the difference in value between the property as represented and its actual value. So is that something that you wanted us to look at?
Yes.
Okay. Cost of placing the property in the condition it was represented to be in, including cost of all repairs.
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right.
But he's acting as the sole member of the LLC. How does that create a personal claim for him? I'm still not getting beyond that. The moment we go down that road, you're saying when you have somebody on behalf of a corporation or on behalf of anything, all of a sudden they have an individual claim, which would work the other way then if we decide that's our new law, that then they would have individual liability. Why even bother having an LLC or a corporation?
See, I think that is an argument that goes too far. We're not arguing, nowhere in the briefs, nowhere in the Court of Appeals decision, did anyone identify the LLCs and the separation between the LLC and its members. There was a recognition of their relatedness, both in time through the assignments and through their relationship as being sole member, managing members, agents of the LLC. That's very significant and very different from the argument that we have sellers way down the title line and buyers way down the title line being entitled to sue. You don't have to go that far in this case. The facts of this case is one seller, a real estate condition report that was delivered to Lewis Pagoda's, and the offer to purchase contemplated assigns as parties to this contract. One of those assigns was Seed, who did take title. So Seed should be entitled to go after the misrepresentation that's coming through the contract by the real estate condition report. Seed should be able to sue for the diminished value. The concession that I heard today during oral argument from the petitioner is that we can fix this on remand through cross assignments at the circuit court.
What did you hear that indicated your opposing counsel said this could be fixed on remand through cross assignments? I didn't hear that, so what did I miss?
Well, what I had heard was that while she was criticizing the pleadings, she also said that this could be addressed through a series of assignments. At least that's the way I understood her argument. If that's the case, on remand, that can be addressed quite easily.
How?
Through a series of assignments.
Like, give me an example.
Well, if everybody is today, sounds like they, I don't mean to put words in the court's mouth, but there seems to be a general concession, even from opposing counsel, that Seed has standing to sue. So whatever rights that Louis Pagoda's and his wife may have, any rights that Kearns may have through a series of assignments could assign those to Seed, and we could have a claim by Seed that addresses all of the potential claims that all the parties may have. See, one of the problems we don't know with this record, we know that somebody's doing repairs. We know to the extent of at least $7,000. Who paid that? Out of whose pocket? That person's harmed, or that entity is harmed.
Well, that could be the fairy godmother. That doesn't mean that the person has a claim in this lawsuit. I mean, that could be, who knows, someone out of the goodness of their heart decides they like the place, they like to see it restored. That doesn't give them a claim under contract.
Well, I think Louis Pagoda's is the likely person who's writing the check, whether it's coming out of one of his LLCs or out of his personal pocket.
Yeah, but this is more precise than that.
This is a motion to dismiss the complaint. So we look to the complaint and we make a decision. Is there anything based on these allegations that survives? We have a buyer, that is the LLC. We have a member of the LLC who seemed like they were part of the transaction because members are usually, they are acting on behalf of the LLC. I don't see how you get a person to be able to claim that somehow they have a claim other than what the LLC would have. What makes their individual claim survive here?
Well, it's my argument that the contract was originally entered into with Louis Pagodas. And under the breach of contract elements, he was induced into proceeding forward and ultimately assigning it to his LLC. He had reliance upon those
and
representations.
The LLC should sue him, maybe, for damages.
Well, and you then, know, he would have a claim against Amy because whatever suit that he has coming towards him is based upon his conduct through the contract in detrimental reliance upon the misrepresentations that were given to him. He pushes forward with this acquisition and places title into the name of his LLC based upon the reliance of the information that he's received.
That's
received as an agent or received as an individual?
That's the LLC's claim.
Well, why can't it be Louis Pagodas's? He received that. He received the misinformation and he acted upon it. He was induced. Those are the elements.
Well, counsel, in the complaint, though, again, relying on the specific allegations in the complaint, and if you can point to something in the complaint that suggests we should look otherwise, but the interest that is identified for Louis and his wife is that they are all the only members of Kearns and Seed, quote, through those entities have a direct economic and financial interest in the property. So according to the complaint, whatever interests that they may have, it appears to be through those entities. It's clear they're doing some personal things because it also says they purchased it with some that should be marital funds, but that their interest is through, that it's not them individually, that their actions, their economic interest in this as plaintiffs is through the LLCs. So we're just trying to read the complaint, construe the complaint reasonably, which I think is what we're supposed to do, regardless of the pragmatics of the situation. We've got a piece of paper we got to rely on.
Well, I do think that in the complaint there's a reference to plaintiff and plaintiffs, plural. I don't think it's clear from the complaint which plaintiff. I mean, that's part of the problem here, one of the reasons it's being sent down on remand. To the extent that there was some sort of detrimental reliance and an out-of-pocket expenditure by Lewis, I think that should be recovered. Whoever has been deceived by the real estate condition report, and I think we can agree that multiple people and multiple entities may have been the victim of that, they should be allowed to recover the money that was expended in detrimental reliance. I mean, that's providing a remedy to those people that are harmed. We shouldn't find ways to avoid compensating those people that have suffered a harm because of the deceit or the misinformation and the misrepresentation. So I think that's what the Court of Appeals was doing, is remanding this back so that we can figure out who is out money, who has the standing to recover that. I don't find it difficult for the recovery of losses to someone who is a party to a contract and detrimentally relied upon it. Even if he has title in the name of his LLC, if the money's coming out of his pocket and he was the recipient directly and indirectly, both as agent and as individual, and he acts upon that, he's harmed. He's damaged. He should be entitled to recover that. I would like to address a few other things, if I may. The 533, we haven't talked much about that, but I think it's very important to point out that under the facts of this case, we don't have to go to adopting 533. I think 533 in its application in the Court of Appeals was sufficient. I don't think that it has to create the far-reaching implications that have been argued. 533 is very limited in its scope.
Are you saying, I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, are you saying you do not think we need to adopt it?
I do not think you have to adopt to find appropriate remand and to allow the plaintiffs to sort out on remand who was damaged and the amendment of the complaint to allow the case to proceed. I think dismissal was inappropriate, and I think the reversal of the dismissal could be upheld. With respect to 533, there's a couple of arguments that have been made about that. First of all, that is not the facts of this case. We have related, very tightly related parties. We don't have subsequent purchasers and subsequent sellers seeking redress against some seller back in history.
Based on your statement, and I'm assuming that, you know, that was one of my questions on that, too. I just don't see anything in the complaint that, you know, approximates that fact scenario that Section 533 contemplates. That's what I'm hearing you say here, you would say we don't need to address it, we don't need to adopt it, because it's not what you're alleging in the complaint.
Right. To the extent that 533 has any pertinence whatsoever, is that I think if you look at 533 by itself, the wording of it, just to take a second here, it's when there is a misrepresentation to one party and the person that makes that misrepresentation intends or has reason to expect that the terms will be repeated or substance communicated to the other. That's the pertinent language in there that's very applicable here.
So if we're
but
not,
you don't have to adopt
if
it.
If we're not adopting it, why would we go into that language? We have other misrepresentation statutory claims alleged here, right?
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah. And as far as the slippery slope in general, I don't think there's anything in the ruling of this court upholding a court of appeals or remanding this that will cause any pause for any future buyers or future sellers for that matter.
What about 100.18? That was part of the slippery slope argument there, that the court of appeals logic might take you pretty far down the line, that, the court of appeals talks about any person, the statute says any person, and reading the statute to mean that if you make an initial representation at one point in time, I was having a hard time seeing why that logic of the court of appeals wouldn't extend to subsequent buyers if that were upheld. Could you address that?
Sure. 100.18, as well as the real estate condition report by its statutory terms, is directed to the buyer and those people in the transaction. That's in the statute. That's on the form. It's in the offer to purchase. So a real estate condition report that is given in a transaction and is false or misleading is limited to the parties in that transaction. And I believe, without any type of contorted logic, in this case, under the facts of this case, that misrepresentation was received by either an individual with standing or it's the agent of the LLCs who have standing or may have damages. And accordingly, you don't have to go down the road to saying there's some independent third party that can file a claim. We don't have to decide that.
So that argument is based on us accepting that the agents of the LLCs can bring these claims?
That the agents are the recipient for the LLCs of the misrepresentation.
Of the misrepresentation.
Correct. And once again, as I tried to say earlier, the members, by statute, in 183, the member can make a misrepresentation and create liability for the LLC. Why not the converse in this case, where the member, who is acting as the agent and representative of the LLC, receives that information? It's clearly imputed to the LLC. The LLC has received that misrepresentation As if it was directed to the LLC.
Counsel, it sounded like when you were addressing that statute, maybe I misheard you, but it sounded to me like you disagreed with the Court of Appeals holding there, that you think 100.18 is actually a bit more limited and that your analysis doesn't go as far as the Court of Appeals does. Did I hear you correctly?
Well, I'm not making that argument.
Okay.
But
I think the Court of Appeals pretty clearly seemed to say that could extend to future buyers, maybe not forever, but to future buyers. What I hear you saying is 100.18 is directed merely to the parties in the transaction. And I understand we have some disputes about who those parties are here that we need to sort through. But I hear you saying they're limited to the parties of in the transaction, not to later folks. Is that accurate? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that in this case because the 100.18 arises out of the real estate condition report. That's the misrepresentation. That's what's being presented to the public. And 100.18 requires statements that are to the public. It can be one person, but a statement to the public, well, the real estate condition report is widely disseminated in a real estate transaction to prospective buyers. So a prospective buyer under 100.18 in this particular real estate sale or the marketing of this particular property, they have standing. They don't have to have a contract, and they don't have to have a completed transaction, but it has to be a misrepresentation related to this property that was made to the public in general. That's what 100.18 requires. I'm saying you don't have to proclaim that some buyer down the road would have a 100.18 claim. I don't think you have to go that far. The facts of this case aren't there.
Wouldn't the economic loss doctrine prohibit the common law misrepresentation claims, given the existence of a contract?
I think that's certainly a legal argument. It's not before the court. That's not what was decided on the motion to dismiss. That's not what was briefed, and that's not what I'm not prepared to argue because it's not before the court.
Fair enough.
Counsel, with regard to 100.18, it's your position then that the condition report induced Lewis to enter into a contract or obligation?
Yes.
And what was that contract that he was induced to enter into?
The offer to purchase and the warranty deed that took title to the property.
He personally has title?
Well, he has title as the sole member of the LLC. Yeah.
No, he doesn't. The LLC has title. Yeah.
The LLC took title.
So that's why I'm asking what to induce him to enter into any contract. And the only contract you point to is taking title, or is there another contract that you are asserting or could assert? Or?
My light is up. May I answer the
yes.
question? I believe the warranty deed is contemplated as part of the offer to purchase. So by taking steps to consummate the transaction, complete the contract, and take title to the property, he was induced through the misrepresentations. Why would you buy the property with all of those those conditions if you knew about them in advance?
Except he didn't buy the property. That's the problem we're having, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that as the only owner of the LLC,
mm-hmm.
He completed the transaction.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Attorney O'Gorman, if you're not planning to talk about the LLC piece of this, do you think you could fit that in the next 5 minutes you have? I'm wondering what you might say in response to all of Mr. Governs arguments.
Thank you, Justice. So the LLC issue is problematic. As we briefed, the Court of Appeals said several times that these were related LLCs, made much of the fact that the transfers were between related LLCs. And it's Amy's position that we need to look at this case as if it is Amy sold to Frank, who sold to Bill, that they're separate people, that you don't get to treat them differently because they're related. We think that that creates kind of a chink in the LLC armor, and obviously LLCs are very important in this state for businesses. Businesses look to them for that liability protection, and if we're going to start breaking out differences, whether they're commonly owned or not, people are going to have to rethink the ownership of their LLCs. So in response to some of what was just spoken about, I think the reference to 709 and the real estate condition report as being just with regard to that transaction, I would love to say that's true, but I don't think it is. I think it applies to prospective purchasers, and I think a plaintiff of some sort down the road could take the position that a prospective buyer is someone not necessarily in that transaction if they are prospectively looking to buy the property later. I think that there's no way to get to recovery for Kearns without the adoption of 533 under these facts. Again, I'm not saying that Wisconsin law provides them no recovery. I'm saying the way that it was brought, incorrectly in our position, but the way that it was brought means that in order for Kearns to make a claim back at this point, I think it does require the adoption of 533. And we're not advocating for that, but I think it's important to note that I think it does have to happen. I don't think there's a way that we can just say, well, leave 533 over here and we can go ahead and grant it on some other grounds. I don't think that's possible. I also do think that there is a slippery slope. Under 100.18 or otherwise, the language under 100.18 is, of course, a statement to the public, but then from there, you know, there's no limitation. If we're saying that a third party can sue based on an indirect fraudulent misrepresentation, we're going to see a lot more lawsuits. And it's not just in the real estate context. I think that's part of it. But it applies in all kinds of contexts. So not necessarily buyer-seller, but the plumber. There's a case in one of these other states that has the restatement where there's a plumber who does work on a property, and then there's a sale, and then the subsequent buyer is able to sue back to the plumber. I think in Wisconsin, the plumber doesn't expect that he's going to be sued by some, you know, unknown to him future buyer of the property. He might expect, hey, if I do a bad job, I'm going to get sued by the person I was in contract with or the homeowner of the property at the time that I did the work. But I think it is a bit dangerous. I think that allowing people to not only skip the line in the real estate context, but sort of all over the place, there are all sorts of applications where we're now saying, fraudulent misrepresentation, go ahead, you know. And if you're not sure who it is, sue them all. Might as well, because somebody has to be responsible. And I want to be clear that we're not advocating here for the con man or the fraudster who's out there doing something wrong. Amy Keitel has maintained this entire time and still maintains her innocence, that she has not hit or done anything to anyone. But what we're saying is that the effects are too broad. To say that we're going to allow people to go out and sue everybody directly on an indirect claim is dangerous.
What do you mean by an indirect claim? I don't want your argument to all of a sudden severely circumscribe 100.18. I mean, you can bring, as was advanced, you can bring a 100.18 claim without a contract, right?
Yes, that's correct. But the issue is that when someone is making a claim under 100.18, the elements require that it's between the person who made the representation and the person who received it. It's not to some other unknown person. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for your oral arguments. This matter is adjourned. We will meet at 10 to 3 in conference.